Welcome to another edition of Always Right with Rochelle, the Right Now Coach. Today I'm delighted to be talking with Jeanette Hurt. Jeanette is an award-winning author who writes for numerous food, wine, and travel publications, including Gourmet, Relish, Budget Travel, Parenting, and Wine Enthusiast. She's also the author of The Complete Idiot's Guide to the Cheeses of the World, a guidebook that explores the world of international cheeses, and The Cheeses of Wisconsin, a culinary travel guide. Welcome, Jeanette.
Thank you, Rochelle.
Well, clearly you're interested in cheese. So how did you happen to write two cheese books with a third book on its way?
Well, let me tell you about my saga into the world of fromage. I've always liked cheese. My grandfather was actually a dairy farmer before he moved to Chicago for work. So there, I guess you could say dairy is in my blood, but I'm actually a city girl, having grown up in Chicago and then having lived in Milwaukee most of my adult life. I became a freelance writer about 5.5 years ago, and one of the things I've done as a freelancer is I've written a gourmet newsletter for a gourmet food store here in Milwaukee, and they feature a lot of cheeses. And in fact, they're Larry's Market, and
wow.
If you're ever in Milwaukee, I do recommend you stop there for cheese. But anyway, I was writing their newsletter, and I would write about cheese. They'd tell me about whatever latest cheeses they'd have, and then I'd write about it, and then I'd have to go and buy the cheese.
Hmm.
The more as I work I did as a freelance writer, I realized, you know, there's something to this artisan cheese movement that's going on, and so I wrote a book proposal. And I sent it to an agent, and she tried to sell it, and it didn't work.
Hmm.
Then about a year later, I met the acquisitions editor of the Countryman Press, and they had published a book, The Cheeses of Vermont. And I said to her, well, you know, you have a book called The Cheeses of Vermont. You really ought to have a book called The Cheeses of Wisconsin. And she said, you know, you might be right. I also talked about some other book ideas. And two of them were turned down. And my third proposal, The Cheeses of Wisconsin, when it was being reviewed by the sales and marketing team in New York, I shipped them a basket of Wisconsin gourmet artisan cheeses.
Yum.
Because I figured, you know, I can write about it, but they won't get it unless they taste it. And they were impressed, and I sold my first book proposal. Now, the funny thing is after I sold that, my agent was able to resell my other cheese proposal. And because neither publisher saw each other's book as a competitor, that's how I ended up with two cheese books. I will have a third one next year, The Cheeses of California.
With Countryman as well?
With Countryman. And actually, my third book chronologically, however, is The Complete Idiot's Guide to Tapas, which is also with Alpha Books.
Cool. Well, okay, so I noticed that The Complete Idiot's Guide to Cheese covers how to make cheese as well as the history of cheese in all these countries and what it looks and smells like around the world. So what does research look like for a book like The Complete Idiot's Guide to Cheeses of the World?
Well, first of all, you have to have some background in the subject, which I did, having written several magazine articles before I even started writing the book proposal. So I knew, I had a good sense of who was who in the cheese world.
Hmm.
I also did, basically checked out the entire library on cheese at the Milwaukee Public Library set, which meant at times I had 30 books on cheese in my living room.
Wow.
I also did a lot of research online. I interviewed people over the phone and via email. And then I worked with my co-author, who is my expert. He didn't write the book, but he confirmed everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's the owner of Larry's Market, Steve Ehlers. And so I would research things, and then if I had questions, I'd confer with him. Basically, with an idiot's guide, you have 3 months to write the book from the signing of your contract, sometimes less.
Wow. So how did you organize your days to make that work?
Basically, it depended on where I was in the deadline cycle. I started slow because part of it is learning the whole format of the idiot's
mm-hmm.
guide. You have to change margins on the page, and there's certain spacing and size of the type and all of that. They have it very formatted so it's easier for them to go straight to printing. As a result, that was a challenge for the first chapter. Once you get into the style and the voice, you kind of get a rhythm, and then you just sort of set to it. I mean, there were days when I knew I had to write a chapter a day, especially towards the end, and so that's what I did. You know,
wow.
My chapter on the cheeses of Great Britain, so I took all my research on Great Britain, took all of the little extras, because that's the other thing with An Idiot's Guide. You have all these different funny and fun sidebars and weird facts. So, you know, pulled out research on writings about cheese by Shakespeare, things like that. If you're a good researcher and a reporter, my background prior to becoming a food and travel writer is I was a newspaper reporter for about a decade. And one of the things I learned from my very first job is if your mother says she loves you, check it out. And that was the mantra at City News Bureau in Chicago. And anytime I don't check things out fully enough, I get in trouble.
Wow.
So for something like this, you have to really do just a lot of research, and you have to be disciplined.
Well, I'm curious about just the amount of details, and I think one of the things I love about the Complete Idiot's Guides are those little kind of fun facts and additional information that you have in little boxes all over the book. So how did you keep track of that extra information?
I wasn't very organized. I move kind of more intuitively towards things, but I would know that every other page or so I would need a fun fact. So in my research, usually online, for example, the chapter that includes some Turkish cheeses, I have a friend who married a wonderful Turkish man, and I found a video on YouTube where there was some guy singing about cheese.
Wow.
I double-checked that with him, obviously, because I don't speak Turkish. But if you're searching for specific things, then you'll find weird facts. The chapter on Canadian cheese, there's this one guy who is considered, I think, their worst poet. He wrote this big ode to mammoth cheese. And there was this whole society at one point dedicated to him, and there used to be a contest every year for writing a poem in his style. You just kind of find those, and I would print information off, or I'd mark it in books, because that's the other thing. When you have about 20 or 30 books on cheese sitting on your living room coffee table, you know, I bookmarked a lot of things and sticky-noted a lot of things.
Wow. So you were just basically living, breathing cheese for all those months.
Pretty much.
Well, it looks like you did some travel and interviewing for both of the books.
Yes, I did.
Can you give some tips to our listeners on making the most of an interview?
Well, the thing is especially in terms of an interview, always have a list of questions that you need to have answered, but you have to sometimes let the dictates of the interview. Somebody will mention, you know, their grandmother used to make cheese, so you got to ask them about their grandmother if you didn't know that ahead of time. And you also have to sometimes keep track of time.
Yeah.
And that was hard for my Cheeses of Wisconsin book. I mean, I was on the road for about 3.5 weeks just visiting creameries and cheesemakers and traveling around the state. I could only at most visit about 4 a day besides traveling between the distance between the cheesemakers. It was the time necessarily to spend talking with the cheesemakers, trying their cheese, and just touring their plants usually.
Yeah. So how long would you spend with each of these cheesemakers?
About 2 hours.
Well, and was that enough for you to get what you needed?
It was enough. The other thing is you always have somebody's phone number and email in case you have more questions. Some interviews were 3 hours or 4 hours, but a lot of them were just 2 hours because I didn't have enough time.
Yeah.
And some of them had wilder or longer stories to tell, so you gave them a few more paragraphs, and some of them were pretty busy and didn't have enough time to talk, so you adjusted accordingly.
So now I noticed that a number of the photos in the books are by you.
Yes.
Are you a trained photographer, or is this just something that...
I took a class in photojournalism at Marquette, and I got the lowest grade in my class. I also must tell you that my first photos ever published, which were in the Milwaukee Sentinel, I know just how bad the photos were because I was an editorial messenger at that time, so I carried the note from the photo editor to the lab, and her note was, these photos are really bad. See what you can do with them.
Wow.
The main thing I've learned about photography is if you have a digital camera and you can do high resolution or super high resolution, which is like 300 DPI, will probably find some photo that will work. But the main thing is you take a lot of photos. If you take 200 photos, chances are you'll have at least a handful that could be usable.
Wow. And in a book like this, as the author, do you pay for the photos that you don't take to be included, or do they pay?
You get permission, and basically you're beg, borrowing, and stealing, kind of, except you don't steal photos. But it's basically, hey, do you have any pretty photos of cheese? And in both books, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board was extremely helpful. They have a library of thousands of cheese photos. And that, for me, was very helpful because they were able to just send the photos. As long as they got credit, they were happy to have them in my books.
Wow, so you weren't paying royalties for all of your photos.
No, and frankly, you don't get paid enough as an author of one of these books to be able to afford photos.
Yeah.
Now, with my latest book, the Tapas book, I had some real trouble getting photos. I had some from different chefs, and that was great, but because I developed most of the recipes in that book myself, I didn't have the photos. So one of my photos is running in that book, but fortunately on a trip to Spain in researching the photos, there was a writer and her husband's a photojournalist, and he's looking for more exposure, so he was happy to take some food photos for me.
Oh, that's great. So you'll use his photos, and he won't charge you?
He won't charge me. It'll give him more credibility as a photographer because that's not his main career. But he takes gorgeous photos. So that'll be great for him, and it's a win-win situation for me.
Well, now, probably our listeners are hearing the word trip and, you know, journalism, and, like, how does this work that you get a trip as a writer? How do people get to do stuff like that?
It's press trips.
Okay.
I've always loved to travel. I speak Spanish fluently, and I'm skilled in French, and I know a little Japanese as well. But so I've always traveled, and I've lived abroad. But what, in terms of getting into travel writing, it was one of those things when I was starting out as a freelance writer. When you start out, you'll write about just about anything and everything. And I just happened to do a story that actually never ran about Grand Rapids for a local publication right after the ferry from the high-speed ferry from Milwaukee to Michigan was established.
Mm-hmm.
And in the course of researching this story, I was invited by one of the local Convention and Visitors Bureau people who told me, hey, we're having a press trip. Would you like to come on this trip? And I said, sure. Not knowing what a press trip was, what my responsibilities would be, or any of that. But I went, and not only that, but I was able to sell 4 travel stories from it.
And that trip was to?
Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Wow.
And the thing is also as a travel writer, I do travel. But for the most part, I write about Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Chicago. I write about home for travel publications.
Mm.
So I think the main thing is you have to have some credibility. They're not going to just invite anybody on a press trip. But I was invited because I actually was working on a story.
Wow.
And but once you get on one press trip, if it's through a public relations firm, you get on their list. So then you get invited on another trip. And if you sell stories based on your trips, then you're invited on more. Right now I'm invited on more trips than I actually can go to, mainly because when you're busy writing, traveling takes time away from writing. And unless I have an assignment or it's a place I really, really, really want to visit and I can really see that I would be able to write some stories from something, it's not something that I go on.
Yep.
And the other thing is it sounds more glamorous than it is. Yes, it's fun. Yes, you see behind-the-scenes tours and you're staying at great hotels and eating wonderful meals, but you're working. Last fall, I took my husband along. I was able to take my husband along with on a couple of trips. One was a personal press trip in which I had to make all the arrangements with the local PR people, and another was one that I was just invited on. And he was just dumbfounded at the breakneck speed where you go from one thing to the next and you're gathering information and you have hardly a moment to catch your breath. When you're traveling by yourself, it's a little more leisurely. If you want to sleep in, you can sleep in. Not when you're on a press trip. If they've got you scheduled to meet somebody at 7 o'clock in the morning, then you might be getting up at 5:30.
Wow. Well, let's go back to the Complete Idiot's Guide. It was fun for me to read because it had so many interesting facts, and it was kind of witty and funny. So I'm wondering what tips you have for keeping nonfiction writing is interesting.
Well, for one thing, I guess in order to be an interesting writer, you have to be an interesting reader.
Hmm.
And one of the basic things I learned back when I was 16 years old and just starting to write for my local newspaper, I was covering board meetings and writing features for the Villa Park Review and the Lombardian. And before I even wrote my stories, I looked at the stories that were written and published in the paper, and I structured my stories accordingly. Okay, how many words were in the lead paragraph? I would actually count them. How many sentences? How did they structure it? And then I would model my stories accordingly. You kind of do the same thing with a book that's in a series. You look and read other books that were written. Obviously, your own voice will come through, but you have to start somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
For example, with the Cheeses of Wisconsin, I looked at the original Cheeses of Vermont. How many paragraphs were devoted to each cheesemaker? I counted and figured out, so I'm like, okay, that's how I judge it. And in terms of keeping things witty, if you read interesting things, you'll be able to adapt styles to your own voice.
Well, that's good. Now, do you have recommendations for our listeners, people that you really...
It depends on what you want to write. If you want to write about food, you need to read food sections of newspapers and magazines and, of course, cookbooks. If you want to write about travel, study travel sections and publications and even websites. If you want to write about parenting magazines, see how they write the article.
Yeah.
And it's different from one publication to another. Parents is not like parenting, is not like child, is not like Wonder Time. They're all different. And most serious freelance writers study magazines. Some of them will go to the library and look at several back issues. There are plenty of conferences I've gone to where editors have presented their magazines, and Media Bistro and freelancesuccess.com have guides for people about different magazines. And you have to pay to be a member to access those things, but it's worthwhile. I mean, why pitch a beauty product story to X Woman's Magazine if it's all done in-house?
Right.
And if you know that ahead of time, that's easier. But the other thing is you kind of study, if you're doing magazines, you study, well, what does the magazine typically write about? I have a friend who used to work at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Features Desk, and she told me, you don't know how many times we get requests for poetry. They don't publish poetry.
Right.
And it's things like that. So know your market. And in terms of books, the main thing you need for books is to write book proposals. And I wrote eight different book proposals before my first book proposal sold.
Wow.
And, you know, there's no guarantee that you write a book proposal that it's going to sell.
Right.
But I always told myself, well, you know, I'm learning how to write a good book proposal. And the more proposals I write, eventually one of them's going to sell.
Yeah. Well, that is a good way to think about it. Practice.
Well, you have to, especially because that's the same thing with query writing. You craft this perfect query that you send to an editor, and it may not sell. I mean, when I first started freelance writing, I had this one story that I thought would be an instant for a woman's magazine or a national publication. It was rejected 9 times before it sold.
Wow.
And I still get rejected.
Wow.
I mean, and I also still get ignored. And I think that's probably, especially when you're starting out, the most frustrating thing. You send out these queries via email or mail, and you never hear from anyone. And it's just very frustrating and disheartening, and you wonder, maybe I'm not supposed to do this. Am I not a good writer? What should I be doing? But the main thing is you've just got to keep at it.
Wow. Well, that's encouraging. It's good to hear that, and I hope all of our listeners hear that too. I just heard a coach say, if you're not making 5 offers a week, then you're not really doing your job. And I think that's the same with writing. An offer to me in writing is a query letter, some way of getting your stuff out there.
It's you have to go out there. And there's a whole knack to writing query letters, and every freelance writer does it differently.
See, I noticed that your book has recipes. I'm wondering if you could talk about what kind of experience or preparation it takes to write books with recipes in them.
Well, I've been probably cooking as long as I've been writing.
Wow.
I've been writing since before I could read. I would dictate stories to my mom. And then as a little girl, I was going to write a doggy cookbook, and my parents, bless their hearts, let me cook cycle dog food on top of the stove. It doesn't really smell that good. My dog thought it was wonderful because I would open up the cans of dog food and then add stuff to it, and I would cook, and I'd call it Doggy Delight.
Wow. So you've been, like, writing cookbooks for a long time.
But, obviously, those early endeavors have never sold, nor do I think most people would be interested in replicating those recipes. However, I've always been a foodie. When I was a little girl, I remember when I was 6 years old, if I had read 100 books, the rule in my family was I could go out to dinner with the family to my favorite restaurant. And my favorite restaurant was the Magic Pan, which is a crepe restaurant. Not typical for a 6-year-old, but that was where my interest lied. As I got older and lived on my own, I would cut out articles and recipes, and I had cookbooks, and I'd try them, and I'd experiment. And then I started taking some cooking classes. And that was very, very helpful. If you can take some professional cooking classes for the home chef, that's a good way to get started. And I've written about and interviewed several chefs, so I've learned different things through writing stories. I did a story for Relish magazine recently on homemade salad dressings and salads, and one guy recommends you always blend your oil and vinegar in a blender or a food processor because it stays emulsified better than if you just whisk it. I never would have done that myself, but I found that it works great, just as the chef said it would. Besides that, in terms of developing recipes, you have to test things. And you have to know certain things, the way things would react to kind of combine and develop recipes. And some of the recipes in my books are recipes that I've been making for years. Now, the hard thing with something like that is I don't measure things when I'm just cooking for myself. You know, I just know when something's done instead of realizing, okay, it's 5 minutes on one side. So for things, especially for the Idiot's Guide, you have to follow a certain format, and you have to include information like time, how long it takes to make a recipe.
Well, I imagine you got to explain to us idiots how what it looks like and all the things that you just come naturally to you.
Yes.
You have to say, well, you know, the bread's got to feel like this or whatever.
Yes.
Wow. Well, do you have a final tip you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, I think my biggest tip for anyone who wants to be a writer or yearns to write is you have to be persistent, and you can't take rejection personally. And those two things go hand in hand, whether you're writing fiction, nonfiction, whether you're interested in articles or short stories. The main thing is you have to keep at it, and the more you do it, the better you get. And if you approach it as, I'm just doing this because I like to do this, you'll be a success. And sometimes you have to kind of trick yourself. Like when I was writing those 8 book proposals and I had my fingers crossed and was saying prayers that one of them would sell, and then I'd get the rejection. And that's really hard. But I figured, okay, I had fun writing this proposal. It was an interesting learning experience. And the more you do it, the better you get. One of my dear friends, Damon Brown, it took him 42 rejections to sell the book that he's been dying to sell. And it's called Porn and Pong, The History of Sex and Video Games.
Wow.
It was rejected 42 times. He had 2 different agents. He tried university presses. He was ready to go self-publish until I suggested one publisher he hadn't tried, and then suddenly he sold it.
Wow.
And I think the more I talk to other writers who are successful, the name of the game isn't being the best writer in the world. It's not even having the most connections. It's being persistent and not taking no for an answer.
Great advice, Danette. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
I'm glad to have you here on Always Right. This has been another edition of Always Right with Rochelle, the Right Now Coach. You can find a link to Jeanette Hurt's website and her new books at my website, rightnowcoach.com. Thanks for tuning in, and remember to always write.